Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and good afternoon to all of you who are listening via the World Wide Web. My name is Deborah Freeman, and on behalf of the LaRouche Political Action Committee, I'd like to welcome you to today's discussion. Obviously, with the paint barely dry on the walls of the new Congress, we have come into a very important moment in American history. And I think that there is little question that what we do over the course of the next days will determine not only the immediate future of the United States, but in fact the future of the world. We have a new Congress, one that many of the people gathered here in this room and people who are gathered around the United States participating long distance in this event played a critical role in bringing about. It's a new Congress which is full of promise and hope and optimism. But whether or not we can deliver on that is yet to be determined. Clearly, last night, the American people got something of a flavor of what the other side has to say. And I think that it's fitting that today the American people will have the opportunity to hear a more historically American voice on what the future should hold. There is a lot more that I could say, but I really think that since people have been so anxious to hear what Lynn does have to say in this new period in American history, that the best thing to do is simply to ask you to join me in welcoming Mr. LaRouche.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I think we should begin by declaring this the year of bel canto choral singing. Which is one of the most important weapons available to us to change the world and to transform people who look glum and miserable on the streets into actually smiling and happy human beings. But we have to justify that happiness at the same time. We can proclaim it, we can declare for it, we can call for it, but we must make it possible. Now, what has to be done to save civilization, global civilization, not just here, must be done largely within a span of the coming 90 days or less. Now, of course, the first thing we must do in order to do the other things which we must do, we must put the vice president into some form of retirement, involuntary or otherwise. And we must put the President of the United States under compassionate care. Because without the removal of these two impediments, civilization will not continue. You see, this madman, who's the unshackled husband of a terrible wife, they have such things in history. You are going to have war. You're going to have a war spreading throughout the entire region, from Turkey and so forth into Somalia and beyond. The whole world will blow up. We are entering a period of the greatest financial crisis in all modern history. Because this time, while there are comparable regional cases, such as the 14th century New Dark Age, never before has the entire planet been threatened by virtual extinction of its culture and mass depopulation as now. So therefore, this is unprecedented. What we're going to have to do is what the Congress in general presently hasn't the slightest intention of doing, but it must be done if the nation and civilization are to survive. There is no force outside the United States which has the intellectual capability and influence to do what must be done in reorganizing an international monetary financial system and economic system which is bankrupt beyond repair. The world will not continue as a civilized world under the present international monetary financial system and the prevalent policies which have evolved in the world, as from the United States and elsewhere, over a period from about 1970 to the present time. We went, during that period, from a nation which, despite all our errors and follies, still had a residue of the legacy of President Franklin Roosevelt. For example, Roosevelt took back at the historical setting which leads into the present. When Roosevelt came into the presidency, virtually, with a couple of exceptions, every president since the assassination of President McKinley had been a national disaster. We allied ourselves with our traditional worst enemy, the United Kingdom, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. This alliance, with the killing of McKinley, opened the gate by bringing in a nephew of a Confederate traitor, Teddy Roosevelt, into the government. Roosevelt marked the change. You had an intervention of a Taft presidency, which was not so bad, but the legacy of Teddy Roosevelt held over that. Then you had a man who was a passionate advocate of the Ku Klux Klan, and who relaunched the Ku Klux Klan's building as a mass movement from the inside the White House, Woodrow Wilson. So over the period, from that you had the end of World War I. You had, from 1901 to that time, you had a degeneration of the U.S. political scene and of the mentality of our people. This was reflected in the 1920s by the so-called flapper age. While the U.S. economy continued to stumble along into the middle of the 1920s, it actually was on the way down. And by the time of 1929, the whole thing began to collapse. So at that point, you had from 1901, with the date of the assassination of McKinley, until the entry into the White House in early March of 1933, you had, our country was run, largely dominated by a corrupt clique centered on London and what was called Wall Street. These guys were the guys who, at the time that Roosevelt went into office in 1933, leaders in Wall Street, such as the grandfather of the current president of the United States, were pro-Hitler. It was Prescott Bush, the granddaddy of George W. Bush, who signed the paper issued to a bank in Germany to release U.S.-controlled funds to revitalize financially the Nazi Party in time for Hitler to be made the dictator of Germany. This was typical of the wealthy families associated with Wall Street, all tied to London. And they weren't doing it on a U.S. initiative. The initiative came from the Bank of England, from the head of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, in which the British intended to set up a new geopolitical war on the continent of Europe, focused upon the issue of an attack on the Soviet Union. And this war was to demolish continental Europe as it had not been thoroughly demolished during World War I. This was a geopolitical move by the Anglo-Dutch financial liberal circles of Europe. And we had in our Wall Street, and in our political system, we had the patsies who were going along with that. Roosevelt changed that. Franklin Roosevelt returned the United States to the tradition of the founders. Among the founders, of course, was his ancestor, Isaac Roosevelt of Wall Street. And Isaac Roosevelt, who was an ally, collaborator, of the former Secretary of the Treasury, and Hamilton. And that is the Roosevelt tradition. It is not a Roosevelt as such tradition. It's the revival of the principle of the U.S. Constitution, which had emerged, in particular, in 1763, when the British Empire was first created at the Peace of Paris in February 1763. So this is a long American tradition. It goes back to the time that my first ancestors landed on these shores. From England, of all places. And some came by way of Canada from France in 1648. So when my ancestors arrived here, they arrived not because they were running away from something as such. They weren't, but they were coming to take European ideas, the best European ideas of that time, to bring them to a place at a relatively safe distance from the European oligarchies in order to plant these ideas on these shores and develop a new nation, a new civilization. That is our heritage. Our heritage expressed by the American Revolution, by the formation of the Constitution, by the all-powerful, superior policy of our Constitution, the preamble of the Constitution, which is the fundamental law of our nation for all true patriots. Because it's a commitment, which I referred to, of course, in this recent paper I've written on the question of capital budgets. All right. So what Roosevelt did was to respond to a deeply embedded tradition. Now, some of us know that we weren't born yesterday. It's not talking about about biological youth. It's the fact that our culture is transmitted and enriched from generation to generation as a body of ideas which belong to the specific qualities of the human mind, not to the physical characteristics of the body. And these ideas, which reach far back in history, in the form of the transmission of language and other things, determine what is lying within us, so that you could have a period where, of generations, from 1901 with the assassination of McKinley to 1933 with the entry of Franklin Roosevelt into office in March, you have a period of span of which the most rotten kind of ideas, the most rotten cultural things, like the Charleston of all things. You know, it's the orthopedic surgeon's income promotion game. But the ideas which were planted in the United States in particular, in New England and then in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, in the 1630s, around the Winthrops and later the Mathers, these ideas, which were the ideas that formed our Constitution, with a fresh enrichment from Leibniz and others from Europe, these ideas are the ideas of the United States. This is our soul. This is our character. We are the perfect sovereign who, despite the fact we have a lot of fat oligarchs in our country, we do not have an oligarchical tradition. You don't bow when so fond so-and-so comes by your house. You don't fall in awe when someone says, the Queen. You say, well, I know people with that sexual preference. You do not, because you have a sense, we are an independent people. The personality of the individual is sacred, and that personality has an equal opportunity. That's us. This European stuff, which we moved to get away from, as we had to build a republic for the sake of all humanity, which was as free as possible and as far distant as possible from the European oligarchical tradition. And that's what we are. And whenever you have, in a time of crisis, an able leadership, our people have so far been able to respond to an able leadership to rebuild this nation, even after it has spent drunken decades in a gutter of liberalism. And here we stand today. Now we have people who have entered the Congress. We now have the majority in the Congress. And the majority consists not only of Democrats, but also Republicans who are more inclined to share the general perspective needed to save our nation. Not everyone. we have a nation which is not accustomed to leadership. We've had some leaders of importance in the post-war period after Roosevelt's death. Eisenhower tried to do things. He was actually a product, in a sense, a very significant sense, together with Douglas MacArthur. He was a product of the Roosevelt machine of the 1930s. He understood these things. But he also understood when he became president he was operating within limitations of the time and had to work within the limitations imposed upon him by things like Arthur Burns and so forth at that time. We had Kennedy. And Kennedy promised to be a great president with some fits and starts in the Roosevelt tradition. For that, he was killed. Johnson was terrified. And since that time, the time that Johnson was terrified after the killing of Kennedy, knowing that the fellows who killed Kennedy were on top in the United States at that time, Johnson was cautious and went into the Indochina War. So thus, we had 1968. 1968, the British had collapsed the British pound sterling in 1967. And the way this had happened is Macmillan, the Prime Minister of England, had been kicked out of his post by an orchestrated Profumo scandal. And after an indecent interval, Harold Wilson's first administration was brought into the prime ministership in England. The Wilson administration destroyed the English economy physically to the degree that in 1967, in the fall of 1967, the British pound collapsed. And because the United States was being drained by this new crazy war in Southeast Asia, so because of that, and the 68ers, Nixon and what he represented and Henry Kissinger came into power in Washington. And from that time, despite what Bill Clinton tried to do, he didn't touch effectively the core of the problem. Despite that, we've now reached the point of another long siege of corruption, of one sort or another, in which the objective of the enemy from London, from the Netherlands, and even among us, has been to destroy the United States as a force because we represent a threat to the kind of empire called globalization, which the Anglo-Dutch liberal financier interests, the same ones that brought Hitler to power in Germany, are determined to accomplish today. So therefore we have a government which has not been trained by experience to live up to the measure of its responsibility on this crisis occasion. We have no president in sight. We have a thing called a president. A sick man who's called a president. A sick, wicked man who's called a president. We have a vice president who should be called the president of vice. He's a criminal. He's evil. But he's only a stooge for his wife who is more evil. If you really look at it and what she is and what she represents. They are also tied. They represent not the United States, they represent their friends in London who own them. So therefore, our presidency has been damaged. There is no sense of leadership, of a presidential leadership in the nation generally, except in the bones, so to speak, of some of our leading people and in the population generally. Therefore, we have an important thing. We are not a parliamentary system. And the center of what has to be done is what can be done through largely the major committees of the House of Representatives, as backed by a flood of representatives recently elected to the House, who in the majority represent a force which can be rallied behind the leadership typified in the House by the major committees, relevant major committees, starting with the Ways and Means Committee and others. So it's on these people that we depend to have an interim transition toward a real presidency, which can act as a real presidency according to our Constitution, which can then, with cooperation with the Congress as a whole, can fix what must be fixed in the United States within the next 90 days to fix the future of humanity as a whole. I can assure you, there's no country, there's no part of the world outside the United States in which that capacity for that quality of necessary leadership exists. There are many useful and good people and useful governments in other parts of the world, but they don't have our constitutional system. And it's only under our constitutional system that we can, so to speak, turn on a dime to deal with the greatest financial and economic crisis in all modern history, a global crisis, which is coming on now. The world is ready to go into general bankruptcy. Now look at this from the other side. Take an example. Take the case of Joe, who wants a minimum wage. What's the other guy say? Well, we can't afford it. It'll sink the economy if we give them a minimum wage. Joe says, but I can't live on anything less than a minimum wage. Well, they say, go die for the sake of the economy. Now, what's the problem? The fact is, Joe, two problems. First of all, the tax imposed upon the economy by the loan sharks, such as the hedge funds and similar financial things in Wall Street, is sucking so much blood off the top of the economy by various methods of usury that the cost of usury on the economy is so great, you can't pay the bills for usury and you can't pay the people too. So therefore, the usurers are going to have to be reformed and reduced in wealth. But the problem is also deeper. The fact is that Joe, who's looking for a minimum wage, at least as a floor on which to walk, is not, on the average, productive enough to justify the cost of the economy, of that minimum wage. What are you going to do? Well, you have to change something. You have to change a policy. Well, the policy is this. Since 1970-71, we have made a transition inspired by the 68ers to go from an agro-industrial economy producing food, not biofuels, and I mean biofuels by the people who support that nonsense, so we've gone to a post-industrial ideology. We no longer produce for ourselves. We shipped our jobs out to cheap labor in other countries where their conditions of life there, on the average, are becoming worse. Take the case of China. Now, the recent discussion is that China faces a crisis because it must, to sustain its economy, it must have a certain rate of growth. This growth now is dependent upon its export market. Who's the export market? Us. Chiefly. So therefore, China is facing a very dangerous crisis in itself because, why? Because it has too many poor people. Not that their people should be eliminated, but the point is that the economy has so many people who are poor and not sufficiently productive that it does not have a sufficiently developed internal economy and is dependent upon selling the labor of its people as cheap labor, largely, abroad to sustain the internal economy of China. You have a similar situation, somewhat different but parallel, in India. You have a similar situation throughout the world of the countries which seem to be our growth economies, to which industry has and agriculture have fled. So therefore, you have a situation in which the world as a whole is collapsing. As a matter of fact, you've probably seen the triple curve, which is now in the edition of the, again, published in the edition of this Capital Report in the IR, that over the recent period, most emphatically since about 1977, the productivity of the United States per capita has been going down at an accelerating rate. That is, the physical productivity per capita per square kilometer of the United States has been collapsing, actually since about 1971, 72, but visibly in terms of statistics per capita since 1977. That is, since 1977, take the lower 80% of family income brackets. Their physical income, the physical income measured in terms of physical services and other things, their income has been collapsing at an accelerating rate. You have a section of the upper 20%, that is within the upper 3% of family income brackets, which is super rich without earning anything, actually earning anything. And those who are working in the lower 80% are getting nothing for doing all the work that's available. But in the meantime, we have changed the composition of the economy from a productive economy to a failed economy, a so-called post-industrial society economy, a services economy. And therefore, the services economy employment is largely fake make work. It's the dole. It's like the Roman dole of the Roman Empire. It's a fake. Now, our problem is to restore the United States, in particular, to a major agro-industrial power based on high rates of technological progress, and which will require a very large investment in nuclear fission power. We are going to have to essentially eliminate much of the reliance on other modes of power and eliminate all these, you know, biofuel and other pieces of nonsense that will actually destroy the area and destroy the food supply and destroy the population. We have to go to a high-technology, high-energy flux density power system. We have to do this. Take a case in the western states, west of the Mississippi. You have a large area that runs from Dakota down into Texas, in West Texas in particular. It's called the Oglala Aquifer. This is the major water supply for that whole region. This area is now subsiding, especially in its southern part in the United States. The whole area, this whole area of the world is of the United States is doomed unless we reverse it. Why? Because we're taking the combination of fossil water in that area and the water supply flowing into the aquifer is such that it's less than the rate at which we consume the water in the aquifer. And therefore, you have in West Texas, for example, and similar areas, you have a very serious subsidence of the territory, a destitution, a desertification as a result of this. You have a loss of the potential productivity in a large part of the areas serviced by the Oglala Aquifer. You have around the world, southern India, in parts of the world, are living on what's called fossil water. That is water which was embedded in the crust of the earth, or the upper crust of the earth, since about 2 million years. For example, in India, southern India, one of the largest reserves of water in India, in the Deccan region, the southern India, is fossil water 2 million years old, left after the melting of the Great Glaciation. So now what happened, much of the world is living on fossil water. We have to make water. Now, you know, that has two meanings. In this case, you have to take the case of Australia. Australia has abundant water with much desert inside. Now, how's that possible? Well, the water's outside. It's around Australia. It's saline. And Australia has a wonderful opportunity to use this water in the oceans around it. But how do you use it? How do you desalinate it? Well, the only efficient means we have for desalinating water and cleaning up water on a mass scale is nuclear fission power. It's not the best one for the future, but for the time, this is what you do. The fuel problem. If you have the proper type of nuclear fission reactors, you can take water, which we should be producing by aid of nuclear fission. We can take water, and we can get fuel from water through high temperature, high flux density temperature operations through nuclear power. We can generate fuels, hydrogen-based fuels, from water using certain types of nuclear reactors. That means in every part of the country, if you have a sufficient water supply, you even dirty water, you process it. What you can do is you can turn that water into hydrogen-based fuels and similar derivatives. You don't have to bring oil from Saudi Arabia. You can make a better fuel right here at home. Now, this is the direction in which we have to go. We also have to go for the future down the line, We have raw materials management problems on the planet as a whole. We have rich sources of raw materials in northern Asia and parts of Russia. We can generate in that area a great improvement in the supply of raw materials at acceptable prices for Asia as a whole, an area of growing population, a need for growth, technological progress. We can do that. But to do that, we have to go into thermonuclear fusion management techniques of materials to reprocess and process materials in a creative way to ensure that the supply of raw materials at a reasonable price, reasonable cost, is available to every person on the planet. We can do that. So don't talk about what seems practical because it was done in the past. Progress is existence. Progress is the only future worth having. Therefore, we have to think in terms of an economy which is oriented toward progress, toward technological progress, and to go away from the post-industrial society which has been killing us. Reject the post-industrial society. You know? Go beyond to the future society, the future economy society, which is what Roosevelt, in a sense, did. He mobilized the people who were poor, destitute, lost skills, put them to work, and moved such that from a nation which had been broken and destitute in 1931-33, Roosevelt produced a nation which represented a power beyond the imagination of anybody who had existed before that time. Producing 50,000 planes a year for war. We won the war. We saved the world from Hitler. Yeah, we had partners in it, but without our role in that, we wouldn't have saved the world. The Britain would have joined Hitler, but for the United States, but for Franklin Roosevelt. It was Franklin Roosevelt who got the British to abandon their intention to support and make out a deal with Adolf Hitler. It was Roosevelt, his leadership, and the development of the economy mobilized under his leadership, which made us the greatest power the world had ever seen. Yeah. And we did it under Roosevelt's leadership. We can do it again. We can do it with this broken, depleted population. We can do it again. Now, the problem is that most people today, particularly baby boomers, were trained in the post-war period not to think like that. You had the various things like Dr. Spock, who turned your baby into a monster and gave you a recipe to do it. Just feed your baby this soup every day and it will become a monster. And it did. So, therefore, we have to look at what's wrong spiritually and intellectually as well as physically. Because the physical wrongs are a result of intellectual wrongs, mental wrongs. We make the mistake. We make the wrong choice. We vote for the wrong candidate. We vote for the wrong policy. We support the wrong idea. And that's how we get into trouble, because we are a nation, according to our Constitution, the people can actually control their government through their influence on the selection of people who and behavior of people in government. We are not an oligarchical society. And when the people move and have leaders that enable them to move in a unified way, we can accomplish miracles. And we're going to have to pull a miracle out of the hat right now. So that's the task before us. Now, what does this mean? The problem of the baby boomer generation, and this was intentional, you had at the day Roosevelt died, the people who came into power were largely people who were determined to destroy Roosevelt's life's work. They could not completely destroy it because of what had happened. The effect on our returning veterans, for example. There were limitations on what the new administrations could do to destroy the United States from inside. So we had a Bretton Woods system for the world, a good system which worked until it was destroyed in the middle to late 1960s, and absolutely destroyed in 1971, 72. We had a good system. There were many legacies. But what happened was that these characters said, as in Europe with the Congress for Cultural Freedom, they said, we have to destroy the next generation. And they did. With the aid of Dr. Spock, with the aid of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, with the aid of the theory, which is actually a Nazi-like theory, the theory of the authoritarian personality. The guy who says, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, he's a nut. He's been brainwashed. If he says, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, what's he saying? He's talking like that Nazi, Martin Heidegger, with his conception of thrownness in society. He's saying the individual is in a conflict with society, that the relationship between the individual and society should not be affirmative, but it's negative, existentialism. This is the book called The Authoritarian Personality, on which many of the social democrats and others in this country worked to destroy the United States from the inside. This is the program that raised the baby boomers. And the upper 20%, the white-collar section of the upper 20% of the family income brackets, they're the ones who were going into the universities. They were the ones who were destined to go into positions of government and other influence. They came up as the 68ers, not as a collection of individuals, the 68ers, but as a social formation, which split the Democratic Party in particular between white-collar on the one side and blue-collar on the other side. And it was a split between white-collar and blue-collar done by the 68ers themselves under the direction of these clowns, which destroyed the Democratic Party and made the Nixon election possible. The problem lies, in a sense, in this direction, that the baby boomer generation was conditioned not to believe in truth. They call it they're against conspiracy theories. Well, all progress in humanity is done by a conspiracy. People agree to change the way they behave, as in technological progress, as in changing the character of institutions, as going for full adult education programs, developing professionals, bringing in new technologies, changing the relations among nations. These are all ideas around people which people organize to make things better. Everything good in society is done by a conspiracy theory, by conspiracy. Everything bad in society is done either by abrasion or by conspiracy theories. If you don't believe in conspiracy theories, you have a mental case and need adult supervision. Because that's the way history has worked. History works on the basis of ideas. The difference between a chimpanzee and a human being is ideas. Chimpanzees don't have ideas. They can't think. If you want to find a society free of the authoritarian personality, look at a cage full of rhesus monkeys. You're a true existentialist. So the problem is, therefore, by denying the importance of principle, the existence of principle, what we did is we gave a generation which is now empowered in our institutions, a generation which is empowered to say, I don't care about the future. I don't like my children. I don't like my grandchildren. I'm tired of supporting them. I don't want to pay for their education. I don't care what they think. I have to live out the remaining few years of my life in what I consider comfort. I don't care about what comes after me. I care about what I feel in the here and now today. Short-term, quick gratification. The sexual behavior and marriage patterns of the American baby boomer. What we have now, the thing we have, which is demonstrated by singing choruses in bel canto mode on the streets of the United States and also in Europe, what we have is the affirmation of a generation of young adults. These young adults are the same generation which was organized by Benjamin Franklin from about 1763 on, when he knew that nature was in danger, organized by him, which made the American Revolution, fought the American Revolution, led the fighting of the American Revolution, and created the Constitution of the United States. The generation of Alexander Hamilton, for example, a product of Benjamin Franklin's mobilization of the young adult generation, no older than the young people of today, between 18 and 25 years of age, between 18 and 35 years of age. In all history, all important changes for the better, and sometimes for the worse, in history of nations has come from that generation of people who are past adolescence in their character, their outlook on life. They are adults in their orientation. And they're looking forward to two generations, approximately 50 years, of their coming life. These are the kind of people who, when they grow older, look at their grandchildren as their investment in the future. The baby boomer, by this kind of operation that was done to them in the post-war period by the Cultural Congress of Cultural Freedom in Europe and similar things here, was destroyed. They were destroyed. They destroyed that moral sense that the human being is not a physical thing alone. It also represents a quality of being, a personality, which is immortal. The part that pertains to ideas of the type that no animal can generate. And if you lose that sense of immortality, then you don't have a sense of what of living in the future after your own death. If you can say, I can live in the future after my own death, then you have morality. You have reason. And you can live and fight and risk your life. Because it's not your mortal life that you're defending, it's your future existence. As an embodiment of ideas and the transitions of ideas that make the future function. And that's what's lacking in that generation. And that is what we're doing, and what you saw reflected in the results of the recent midterm election. The role, the crucial marginal role played by the increasing turnout of young Americans between 18 and 35 years of age in two groups. First of all, the 18 to 25, and then the 25 to 35. And if you look at the statistics on the voting and the turnout patterns with this last election, with the previous elections, you see there has been a fundamental revolutionary change in which a new adult generation is providing the basis for new leadership in the policy making of the nation as a whole and the policy making of the world. And therefore, we get the old baby boomers out of their slumbers and their fat dreams. And we tell them, come on, come back to life. Don't be dead all your life. Come back to life. Commit yourself to the future of this nation. Because the work we have to do must be done over a period of not less than 50 years to come. And we must have a policy for rebuilding this nation and the world over the coming 50 years. And we must realize that in our time, we must adopt the design and lay the foundations for the future of humanity in the sense that Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, attempted to do so when he entered the White House in 1933. That's our mission. And that's what stands before us. Now, since we don't have a president right now, we have a thing. Was like some comic book character. And sitting there, babbling lunatic. The poor guy doesn't know any better. He's sick. He's mentally ill. And he needs care. He has not received the parental care he requires. Maybe we'll have to get some surrogate parental care for him. But we've got to get him out of what he's doing. You don't want to shoot him. He's a human being. He's just a sick guy. What do you do with a sick guy? We try to help him. Well, the first thing to do is help him out of that terrible job he has. Why not? The vice president, I think we ought to chain him and his wife up at night and get ourselves a bright, new, shiny vice president. Now, we don't have those things accomplished right now, though they might come sooner than Cheney likes. But we must have that perspective, and in the meantime, we must say, what are we going to do in the House of Representatives and the Senate, as those are central focus of institutions, what are we going to do to get this nation safely through the coming 90 days or so, preferably less? Now, the main thing we have to deal with, apart from this threat of war, which is essentially a byproduct of the general sickness, what we have to do in the main is we have to recognize, despite all objections to this reality, that we are now in the down phase, the terminal phase of a general global financial system collapse. This is not a depression. This is a breakdown crisis. That if you don't make certain reforms in institutions, you have a situation which the world is collapsing, disintegrating physically as a result of the economic situation, financial situation. So that unless you can change the financial system, you just go into a permanent slide, into a bottomless collapse, a biological collapse as well as a financial collapse. This is worse than a depression. It's a breakdown crisis, comparable to what Europe experienced in the middle of the 14th century, the so-called New Dark Age. That's what the world as a whole faces, unless something is done about it. And what has to be done cannot be done from any other place of origin than right here in the United States. And it must be done, essentially, in the Congress. Now, the Congress is not inclined to want to take on that job. They would like to have a list of our priorities. You know that. Priority 1, 2, 3. Which way do you arrange them? As if putting each of these pieces together will somehow work. It won't. So what the Congress is trying to do, in general, or the better side of the Congress, is trying to do, and more Republicans joining, is to try to take some of the pieces, some of the local issues, specific issues, and deal with those one at a time on the assumption that will work. It will not work. The specific thing is the two things. First of all, an economy, it should not be a money economy. An economy requires the use of money as a way of coordinating the relations among particular individuals, regions, and so forth, within a national economy as a whole. But a national economy as a whole is a physical economy, not a money economy. Now, the difference here is the difference between the British system or the Anglo-Dutch system, which is a monetarist system. In other words, a system based on the authority of money, money per se. So what you do is going to have to behave in the way money wishes you to behave. Rules the British system. That's what's ruling us today. The American system is exactly contrary. The American system of economy is a system of physical economy, not monetary economy. We use a monetary system, just the way the inhabitants of Massachusetts, before 1688, established a money system, a script system, to promote the increase of circulation of goods and production. That's what our system is. This is on the question of on the subject of paper money, dealt with by Benjamin Franklin, which is part of what our system is. We are not an Anglo-Dutch liberal system. We are not a Marxist system. And Marx was a student of the British system and a defender of the British system, a rebellious defender of the British system. So you're either a Brit, an Anglo-Dutch liberal, or a Marxist derivative of Anglo-Dutch liberal, all of which are based on monetary conceptions, the so-called the notion of value, the notion of money value, as a substitute for physical value, the notion that money value determines physical value. Now, most of you know this is silly, because if you look at the curve between the ratio of physical consumption per capita and production per capita in the United States territory, per capita per square kilometer, you see that the physical output and consumption per capita per square kilometer of the United States territory has been accelerating downward, while the money part of the economy has been soaring upward. It's passed the moon a long time ago. It's now left Mars behind, and it's heading we know what where. Now, therefore, as a result of this situation, you have a situation which the American economy faces, that the amount of debt, of monetary debt, outstanding today, is so great that the Federal Reserve System has suppressed reporting of M3. Because they've suppressed the degree to which pure, wild-eyed inflation at electronic rates has been soaring away in order to keep this economy from blowing up. Now, what they do by doing that, the economy is not just blowing up. what you're doing is building up an explosive charge, because the discrepancy between physical value, which is downward, and monetary claims, which are upward, when as related by the price of things, is such that this system is now finished. There's nothing that can save the present world monetary system. Nothing. If you want to obey with the rules of the system, you want to keep the present international monetary system, you're going to go to hell, and probably quite literally, because you committed a big sin by doing that. So therefore, we're going to have to liquidate the international money system. How do you do that? Well, the way you do it is you go to the principles of physical economy as a way of thinking. Now you do what Roosevelt did, but you go a little bit further because the situation is worse. What you do is you put the whole system into bankruptcy. For example, we in the United States must, if we intend to survive, we're talking about the months ahead, not some far distant program, but months ahead. If we wish to survive, we will have the federal government will put the Federal Reserve System into receivership in bankruptcy. We will put it into bankruptcy to prevent a banking collapse, because we have a super banking collapse in every major bank in the United States and relevant system. Every one of them is about to go. They cannot be sustained. Therefore, to prevent a catastrophe, a social catastrophe, and an economic catastrophe, we must put these banks into receivership for reorganization in bankruptcy. We do that in order to maintain the continued function of these same banks in their normal function in respect to the economy and the population. We have to have things paid. We have to have people employed. We have to keep trade in motion. But we're not going to pay this thing on time as demanded. We're going to put it into bankruptcy. And the federal government can do that very simply by putting the Federal Reserve System itself into bank receivership in bankruptcy and reorganizing it in bankruptcy. The power of government to conduct bankruptcy. If we can't do that, you're not going to save the United States. You're not going to save the system. This is not a far distant prospect. This is now. So within the next 3 months, we must expect to face, as early as that, we must expect to face the point of crisis where you either put the systems into bankruptcy or you go straight to hell with no return ticket. That's our situation. Okay, you have to have the guts to do that. You have to have the knowledge to know how to do it. That's number one. Then you have to realize that an economy is not a monetary economy. Money is a mechanism which is realized and regulated as under what we call the fair trade system policy of the 1970s, or 1950s rather. There you had a protectionist system which recognized that money is an idiot. Money does not know what is physical value. So therefore you regulate money by your selective taxations, tariffs, supports, subsidies, all these kinds of things, so that the money system is now trained to try to stay within values which correspond to physical values. And which you, above all, you want to make sure that an industry which is essential is able to earn enough money through the prices of its goods and through regulation to survive. You don't want the industry to close. If it's a useful industry, you don't want it to shut down because of price competition. So you have a fair trade system. You use tariffs, taxation, other mechanisms, regulation, to make sure that the business is not forced to sell its product at a price below the cost of production. That it's able to maintain and increase its capital investment, that is physical capital investment. So you have regulation. You have regulations such as protecting wages, wage levels. You don't want families to fail. So you regulate to ensure that the flow of value through the economy enables families, normal families in normal communities and normal areas to survive and to progress. And that can only be done by the power of government to regulate the economy, including the money economy, the financial economy, to ensure that the physical effects we're creating for people and for the future of our society are what we want. And they are we also reward, a special reward, on ingenuity. And we do not like large corporations particularly. We hate them. Because large corporations have no conscience. Whereas a closely held enterprise, particularly one which is technologically progressive or performs some essential service under the motivation of its leaders. This economy has a personality. A corporation, a large corporation, has no personality. It's not human. It's a, you know, a monster. So therefore, what you prefer is you prefer closely held firms with usually with less than 200 employees, sometimes as high as 500, but less than 200, which are closely held, in which the future orientation is fundamental, in which the leader of the corporate entity and the leaders have two characteristics. Number one, they are looking for the future they are building with that production. They are thinking of the future of the community, of the state in which they operate. They're thinking of the future of a future leadership of the corporation to maintain the continuity of development. They're part of a community of similar like-minded entities which work together to ensure that the local needs of the community are addressed. When these corporate factors become crucial in determining, you know, what's wrong with the school system, the local corporations are part of the process of discussion. What can we do with our resources in this community to deal with this problem? What can we do to improve things in our community? So you have a sense, you have a national approach of policy, top down, but you have bottom up the implementation of the same idea reflected at the local region. You have not a place where people gather, like a mob gathering at a circus, but you have a sense of people combined in their community as neighbors to function together to take care of much of the requirements of that local community and state. That's our federal system. It's based on that. So therefore, what we want is people who are physically useful to society, producing and improving what they do and gaining an influence as they earn their way to recognition. People who, as investors and leaders of industries, are responding to the needs of their community as a whole, who defend the economic interests of their state, their county, their town, their community. We need that. Who think about the interests of the nation as a whole from that standpoint, recognize they're part of a nation and are concerned with the leadership of the nation as a whole. This is the traditional American way. This is the traditional way described by Hamilton in his own terms in his on the subject of manufacturers report to the U.S. Congress as Treasury Secretary. That's what we will have to get to. But the objective is physical, because the increase of the productive powers of labor does not come from the skill in stealing. Enron is not a good model of economy. Productivity comes from the increase in the productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer. For individual labor and individual enterprise to succeed, you must have an economic environment which enables them to amplify their powers of production in that region. You need water systems. You need power systems. Some of these things are private. Some of these things have to be public. But you need all the elements of infrastructure, all the elements of government administration, which enable the local producer, as an individual or as an enterprise, to make a contribution which contributes to the productive powers of labor as defined in physical terms and defined in service to necessary goals of the society. This is what we had as our tradition. This is what we had as the Franklin Roosevelt tradition. This is what we had still in the 1950s as the idea of a fair trade system of society. This is what we lost when the 68ers came into power and said blue collar is no good. Life is good. Industry is bad. Production is bad. Everything stinks. The great unwashed telling us that everything stinks. And besides, apart from that bad breath, you know. So the question here is which I'm focused on with this report on the lost art of capital budgeting, is to understand how this kind of system works. Now, the other aspect of this, which I emphasized there, which is crucial here today, is you look at people, the way they think about the economy, they think about society. They think in a what is called a Cartesian way. Now look, for example, let's take that the case of 1998. August, September 1998, the collapse of the LTCM Corporation speculation. a speculation which threatened to blow out the entire U.S. economy, and which the government under Bill Clinton, with the direction supplied by Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, acted massively to prevent a general collapse of the system at that time. They did not do what they should have done, because the enemies of reform arranged a constitutionally illegal indictment of a president of the United States. And that disruption of the Clinton administration, especially in August, but especially in September of 1998, prevented the Clinton administration, together with its Secretary of Treasury, Bob Rubin, from acting as they knew they had to act to reform the system, to eliminate this factor from the system. What they did instead, as Bob Rubin would probably do today in a similar situation, he's not a politician, he's a banker. What they did was they adapted to the political reality of what they were not allowed to do, which they should have done, to come up with the best possible stopgap arrangement. But nothing was cured. When George Bush came in, after the collapse of the Y2K bubble in 2000, and where you had the prospect of poor Al Gore with this fellow, this sexually interchangeable political figure, Lieberman, there was no optimism in the population, and the voters reflected that in the dubious election of George W. Bush Jr. If you had an ambiguous potential of the Democrats, you had a certain doom in the Republican choice, and therefore people like certainty over doubt. Therefore, they elected that which is sure to doom them, George W. Bush, under the control of babysitter Cheney. So the issue was never faced. We've come to this point. After 6 years under Bush, we've lost it all. There's no more hope. It's gone. Nothing you can do about it. And it was in the terms of the system. So therefore, you have to go back to the American system. You have to go back to the ideas which were generally accepted under Franklin Roosevelt as we went into war, ideas which worked well, even after Roosevelt's death, to the extent they were used, through the middle of the 1960s. And we have to go back to that. We have to go back to the case of the Kennedy launching of the manned landing on the moon and things like that. That has to be the measure of policy making. Do you always have a physical goal, a generation ahead, which is the model way of reference, of thinking, the benchmark of thinking, which points to the future? Because you mobilize people about their sense of immortality. Their sense of immortality lies in what they think they're doing today for the future of the nation and mankind. They're thinking of people who think in physical terms and in moral terms is not short-term, it's long-term. Why do you go to university? For the long-term effect on your life. Why do you reject most universities today? Because they give you a long-term perspective for your life. We need universities which do that again. So that kind of thinking is what's necessary. And the problem is, again, that kind of thinking is missing. But people think in terms of not of society as a process. They think of society as a jungle, a Hobbesian jungle, a sea of conflict in which war is natural. Natural is inevitable. Everybody makes war as an instrument of policy. Other kinds of idiocies are natural. Competition is inherently good because it's competition, even if it's stealing. That's the way it goes. So people don't think about process. They get a statistical report like the Myron Scholes design, or the Black-Scholes formula, which was used by LTCM. Most economists today who do forecasting are idiots, just like Myron Scholes, because they assume that, like Cartesian thinkers, in terms of Cartesian mechanical statistical systems, that you can project the future by taking a trend in bouncing balls from the present into the future. And statistical forecasting is intrinsically incompetence, because the way the economy functions, we work within boundaries. And we are always approaching a boundary, a limit. And as we reach toward that limit, a collapse is inevitable unless we change the boundary. And you change the boundary by introducing a new condition, by improving a political improvement, a social improvement, especially by improving a physical scientific improvement in technology, like the shift into nuclear power, the shift into thermonuclear fusion, the shift into an isotope economy, recognition of the need that we have to manage the planet's supply by improving the supply of life on the planet. Don't complain about the environment, change it. Don't worship the environment, change it. It stinks. Change the baby, it stinks. So therefore, the way you forecast, the way I have forecast, and I've never made a mistake in a long-range forecast yet, but I forecast in ways they don't like. Because I say, here's a boundary condition. Now, let's look at where we are with respect to this boundary condition. And if you converge on a boundary condition, you're headed for a crisis. And you have secondary boundary conditions and primary ones. And I've always forecasted on the basis of seeing the way the system is functioning with respect to a boundary condition. This is called dynamic analysis, which most economists have no knowledge of. And most people in government have no knowledge of this, of dynamic forecasting, of thinking of processes in dynamic terms. This is what the younger people, young adults, in the LIM are studying. They are working progressively. They work to a large degree, work through the study of the ancient Greek roots of modern science among the Pythagoreans and Plato. They've gone directly into reliving page by page, chapter by chapter, the process of the discovery of modern astronomy, astrophysics, by Kepler. They're reliving it. They're not saying, I learned this. They are reliving the moments of tension in the work of Kepler, where they get to a chapter or a page, and it's an unresolved question is posed. Now, what's the answer? Well, they got to apply their minds to thinking what the answer is and find the answer. They go to the next chapter. We still don't understand it, but it's a big problem. They see the problem. And this starts in the first book, that is the New Astronomy. It starts with this issue of the equant, which predicts a crisis in understanding the data of the relative positions of the Sun, Earth, and Mars. And you try to measure this in terms of an equant, you got a tilt, boy, tilt. And this became, of course, the basis for Leibniz's creation of the calculus. So now we're going on from there. We're going through some work on Gauss, which is relevant to this, into the continuity of the emergence of dynamics as a scientific method by Bernhard Riemann. Now, these fellows coming through this, and they're going to get through it within months, and others will repeat it, and have the same experience, will now have a grounding in understanding modern physical science. They won't know many things, but they will know the fundamental central principle of modern physical science. And they will be able to think in those terms, which is most people in society cannot presently think in those terms. Most university professors in scientific fields, for example, are not able today to think in those terms. So therefore, the principle here is to equip a coming young adult generation in the 18 to 35 age group to become self-consciously responsible for the future of humanity and to engage all of the generations of existing society in an effort to make the physical changes in economy by introducing new principles or higher principles which will enable us to increase the productive powers of man per capita per square kilometer, to go to a point of cooperation rather than conflict, and to base their personality on finding their personal identity in the future well-being of mankind. The kind of commitment which brought my ancestors from England and from France into New England and Quebec, respectively, to find a place on this continent at a safe or relatively safe distance from the oligarchy of Europe. On which to take the best achievements of all European civilization and bring them personified into a new country, a new territory, from which to organize the elevation of mankind, to free it from the curse of oligarchy which grips continental Europe still today. Thank you.
Okay. Lynn, thank you very much for those remarks. Let me just repeat for people, some of whom may be with us for the first time today, what the general format is that we will adopt. For people who are here gathered with us in the live audience, if you have questions for Mr. LaRouche, please feel free to submit them. I need you to simply write down your question. If you want me to read the question, then write it out. Pat has index cards for people who would like to do this. If you want me to ask the question, just write it out, identify yourself, and I will try to take your question in turn. If you want to ask the question yourself, that is also okay. I just need your name. And who you represent, if you represent anybody besides yourself, and the topic on which you'd like to address Mr. LaRouche, because we try to group the questions together. For those of you who are listening via the internet, you can, as always, submit your questions, and again, we will try to get to them. We also do have a number of questions for Mr. LaRouche that have come from institutions here in Washington. The vast majority of them actually have come from new members of both the House and the Senate, although there are also several questions from old friends on Capitol Hill. What I'm going to do, I think that As people would expect, a number of questions have come in that relate to President Bush's speech last night and various things that have developed off of that. I will get to those questions, but I'd like to start with some questions that are more directly related to the principal issue that Mr. LaRouche addressed today. For those of you who have not had the opportunity yet to read Mr. LaRouche's paper on the lost art of the capital budget, let me tell you that it is available both as a separate white paper, and it is also in the second issue of Executive Intelligence Review, the second issue of this year's series of EIR. It is also obviously available on the website, and I would urge people not only to make sure that they study it thoroughly, but that they circulate it among their associates. Now, Lynn, the first question comes from the Senate side on Capitol Hill. It is from a Democrat, from a new Democratic senator, and his question is the following. Mr. LaRouche, as you're probably aware, there are two camps that seem to dominate the environment here on questions of economic policy. On the one side, we have the balanced budget freaks. Who insists that every expenditure has to be met by an equal receipt. And they obviously are not a happy group. The other camp takes the position that the deficit be damned. Obviously, you've come in with a third way with your lost art of the capital budget. My question is a specific one, but one that I'd like you to address, and that is, where do you put the massive cost of supporting that section of our population that has been thrust into near poverty, and those who are not immediately employable, either because they are children, because they're old, or because they're mothers who would prefer to stay home and take care of young children? They are not, at least as I understand it, reasonably placed in what you are referring to as a capital budget, yet their needs obviously have to be met regardless of the size of the federal deficit. Could you please give us some guidance on this?
This is a question of thinking in terms of the future, not just the present. Now, we're going to have to put, first of all, any solution to any of these questions of this type have to be situated in the knowledge that we are going into a period very rapidly in which there will be a general collapse of the financial banking system, and in which everything will depend upon the willingness of the federal government to put the Federal Reserve System into receivership for reorganization, and thus to keep the bank's doors open and functioning on essential functions while putting the whole mass of debt through reorganization. Much of it will be canceled. For example, we will not be able to pay gambling debts. Now, financial derivatives, for example, are largely gambling debts. They don't originate in a product of production or useful services. They're simply a form of gambling. The world economy today has become a giant casino, which makes Las Vegas seem very small, though Las Vegas is a part of it. Look at the number of states in which gambling is considered the way to raise taxes to support the community. Look at the case of Louisiana, where they spent money on gambling and didn't fix the levies. You see what the result was. So the problem is that of that nature. So we're going to have to reorganize the financial system, and the first thing we will do is we'll actually move toward canceling all kinds of financial claims which are in the character of gambling debts. That is, investments on speculation and financial investments. Hedge funds. Hedge funds will have to be eliminated. Similar kinds of entities will be eliminated. They will be allowed to sit there but not do anything. So therefore, we have to free the economy from this vast parasitical mass. But we have to come to the core economy, the productive economy, which also has a very large mass of capital investment. And we need more capital infused in order to expand the productive sector of the economy. So we're going into an economic expansion mode, if we are sane. We're going to issue, with the credit of the federal government, under a reorganized Federal Reserve System, we're going to generate federal bills, the authority of uttering by the unique to our system of the federal government. We're going to create masses of capital budget, masses of capital investment, which will be allocated to build up infrastructure and necessary industries. Now, by this means, we will attempt to change the ratio of per capita economic activity in this society. You will still have people who are, in a sense, helpless people. They have nothing presently they can do for themselves in much. They have to stay alive and raise babies and do things like that. We have to protect them. But the key thing here is to change the ratio per capita, per household. We have to decrease services employment, unskilled services employment. Cut it down. Replace it with increasingly skilled employment in physically productive employment. That's the general thing. We want to bring back the factory. We want to bring back the family-owned farm. We want to do things like that, which built the economy beforehand. So therefore, I proposed during 2005, in dealing with the auto industry, said the federal government must move in. The auto industry is going down. So we let the auto production go down. Let it be reduced to a manageable margin. Let's take the capacity, especially the machine tool capacity, of the auto industry. Let's have the government create a corporation to absorb this capacity and use it for what it's perfectly capable of doing, for high-tech infrastructure development. put this as a compliment to the kind of thing that I'm sure that the head of the Ways and Means Committee will do, is to look for infrastructure development, which absorbs youth in particular, who are unemployed or unemployable, and absorbs them in programs which may resemble in some sense the CCC and things like that from the past, from the Roosevelt period. Because we've got to get this youth section in particular, we've got to get them out of destitution. We've got to get them out of degradation. We've got to get them into something where they can build a future for themselves. So it's going to be, in a sense, the character of a physical investment in the future of these people, of these young people. So the main thing is to increase the ratio of physically productive people in the labor force to those who are not physically productive, which means if every McDonald's in the country closes down, that's not bad. The kangaroos will applaud. We don't need most of the services that are being supplied as make-work services. We don't need it. So cut it out and open up opportunities with aid of the federal government. For example, if you take the automobile industry, which has a very important machine tool design factor in it, and things which are auxiliary immediately to machine tool design. Now, the auto industry functions on the basis of communities, or did function on the basis of communities. These are communities of people, which depend upon smaller industries largely, which are actually auxiliaries or ancillary to the auto industry. So therefore, all these communities were based around the organization of the factor of the automobile industry's effect in the areas of, say, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and so forth. So therefore, you want to save these states, you've got to keep the production going. Now, for example, we had Lockport in New York State. Now, Lockport had a capability. It had produced airplanes in the war. It could build systems for building locks and dams and that sort of thing. It had all kinds of capabilities which are there lying in the capabilities of the type of labor force it had and the labor force associated with the surrounding community. Or we have to fix the Ohio River system. Well, there they are. They can do it. They make a big contribution. And similar all the way through. The whole aerospace and similar areas are related to this. So our high technology core is there. Now, around these high technology factors, you have a general labor force, like the auto industry employees and auxiliary industry employees. These people have families. They live in communities. And the fact that they have a machine tool capacity industry there means that they can, that the if where they go, the people go. But the people are there. Okay, keep the work there. Keep the people there. Rebuild the communities. Don't demoralize them as being done today. So therefore, that's the way you organize. You want to shift. Also, you want to kill outsourcing. We don't want deregulation. Kill outsourcing. Look, what have we done? We ship production to China from the United States. Does it benefit the Chinese? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't. It makes them dependent upon us like an addiction. What we do is, when you take the increase of productivity in China, net, caused by outsourcing, with the decrease of productivity in the United States caused by outsourcing, you find that the net contribution of the human race is shrinkage. The same thing is true in all outsourcing. Look at the effect of outsourcing on Mexico. It's lowered the standard of living of the people of Mexico and the productivity of the people of Mexico, while lowering the productivity of the people of the United States. So these ideas of globalization, which is an Anglo-Dutch liberal imperial idea for destroying the United States, we're going to defend ourselves, I hope, against this outsourcing mania, which is a form of imperialism. To take away the culture of the most advanced sectors of the population in terms of technology and shift the responsibility to the least skilled sections of the world population for the sake of cheap labor. And you look at what the change means, taking from productivity away from a high technology area and productive area to a low technology, unskilled area, results in a net lowering of the productivity of the human race as a whole. Not a good idea. And that's what's happening now. So therefore, we have to reorient, we have to use protectionist methods, we have to reorient the economy so that we protect investments in essential industries that we're supporting. We give this protection, and we aim it in every part of the country to make sure that every state in the country is on a functional basis, and that the country as a whole is on a functional basis. And we do that by Roosevelt-style thinking. That is Franklin Roosevelt-style thinking. And we do that. But the objective is always to increase the physical productivity per capita and per square kilometer of the U.S. territory. So we invest in the future. Now, the idiot doesn't understand investment. The idiot thinks it's return on investment on a stock or some other piece of paper. You see what's happening with the real estate bubble. The real estate bubble of the United States is now in a process of collapse, and it's headed toward a catastrophic collapse. That alone will wipe out the entire U.S. economy right now, unless it's regulated. What happens? You have a great speculative appreciation of the nominal value of mortgages. But it's all crap. And it's only most of the construction. We've got nails going from somewhere to nowhere. And they're not even nails, they're tacks. It's junk. It's crap. Shacks. Tar paper shacks, new 2000 style. So this stuff is part of the so-called nominal value of the U.S. economy. But it's crap. And the fact that it's crap is asserting itself every day as this bubble collapses. So therefore, we have to think about the problems this creates. Only the federal government can or should be allowed to create credit in this way. It has to be regulated. We have to regulate the economy to make sure that it doesn't go haywire, that it goes in the right place. We have to look at performance in terms of people, sections of the country, and the general welfare. We have to think of the long term. Where does this take us in terms of capital ratios down the line? We want to increase productivity per capita. We're going to work our way out of this depression. We're going to work our way out of this financial crisis by building up the physical economy. And we're going to be very inventive in going through lists of everything we can do. We're going to go through the drawing boards. We're going to go through the places in government where records of this sort of thing exist. We're going to go through that. And we're going to have committees in the Congress, especially the House of Representatives, which will be concentrating on getting a facility in the Congress. The Congress can vote to have one for itself. This kind of facility where this kind of question is faced, where all the resources of the United States records are available and skills are available to go through this thing to develop a year-by-year approach to improving the productivity of the United States. And by doing that, by regulation, we will get the population in gear. It'll take us 4, 5, 6 years. We'll improve. Crises will be passed. We'll be going ahead as we did under Roosevelt. If you look back to the Roosevelt years from the day he entered office, where he could barely find a pencil in his office on the day he was inaugurated, and a couple of women out in the room outside, and that's where he started. And you're going to have to do it the same way. He went through, with Harry Hopkins' help in designing this program, he went step by step to build up the greatest machine the world had ever seen in a period of less than a decade. And that's the kind of challenge that lies before us now. And we take a hopeful view of this. These kinds of things can be handled. The problem is the way of thinking is wrong. And we have to get younger people more and more into this process. That's young adults in the 18 to 35 age group. More and more of them involved in this. Because it will rejuvenate the institutions of government. Of young people who want to go someplace, not sit and wait to die.
Lynn, we have several more questions that actually go right to the heart of what you just addressed. One comes from is a question raised by the leadership of the Joint Economic Committee, which has members from both the House and the Senate. It says, Mr. LaRouche, as I'm sure you're aware, we are headed for the 5th annual record trade deficit. In November alone, the trade deficit was well over $58 billion, and almost $23 billion of it was from China. On the one hand, we recognize that this problem is a result of the overall collapse of production, and that that has to be addressed. But it is also undeniably the case that it is also due to China's unfair currency manipulation. The Joint Economic Commission will soon open hearings to investigate the appropriate policy response to the growing trade deficit with China and their own manipulation of their currency. Do you agree that as we take the necessary steps to restart American production and to protect it, that we must also begin to take a hard line on Beijing and on its undervalued currency?
We created this problem. It is not something created by China. Don't blame China. Blame the United States and blame the British. Blame the Anglo-Dutch liberals. They created the system. We wanted to control China. Originally, the purpose was to control China as a force against the Soviet Union. This was the Nixon mission. In order to do that, remember, China has many poor people, and they still have a great number of poor people. They require an increase in their employment each year, which is rather fabulous. If they don't get it, they're in trouble. Now, you can't approach this as a China-U.S. conflict policy. It's not. It's a conflict created by the stupidity of the United States. Remember, you would not, what I referred to under the capital budget subject, the world system today is still a dollar system. As a result of the 1930s and a result of measures leading up to the adoption of the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. dollar became the denominator, the currency denominator for the world as a whole. The meaning of monetary value is defined by the dollar. When the dollar was allowed to float, and this was confirmed in 72 at the Azores Conference and elsewhere and later, the dollar still remained to the present day the denominator of monetary value in the world system. Thus, this is one of the reasons why only a reorganization under the dollar could get the world out of a plunge now into a general breakdown crisis. So you don't have to be worried about what's going to happen with the relation with China during the coming months, because you're going to have to change the world system in those months, or you can forget it all anyway. It doesn't mean anything. So the idea of fighting with China over this issue is a waste of time. I know Charlie Schumer's been on this. He's wrong. He doesn't understand the situation. He doesn't understand the issue. All right, now we represent, again, the only credible existing monetary term of account within the international monetary system as a whole. There is no substitute for the U.S. dollar as the denomination of monetary value in the world today as a whole. The only approximate substitute is the British Empire, the Anglo-Dutch Empire, and it is an empire, and it's our enemy. So therefore, what we have to do is we have to, in a sense, we're going to have to intervene on this whole thing with one strategy. We are going to organize a defense of the current value of the U.S. dollar in a relative form of fixed exchange rate system for the world. Because if you get a 20 to 30% collapse in a short period of time in the U.S. dollar on the world market, I guarantee you every part of the world system will disintegrate. Not collapse, disintegrate. Because they'll all be sitting there with their own monetary system, cutting their budgets, cutting their budgets, cutting their budgets, cutting their employing, and going into a dark age. Someone has to create a new system based on the U.S. dollar at a relatively fixed exchange rate standard, which it becomes the standard of reference for every part of the world. Otherwise, the whole world goes to hell if you don't do that. So therefore, any discussion about negotiations with the existing system before that happens is a waste of time. Totally counterproductive, because you occupy yourself with something which is a waste of time when you should be organizing around something which is the only thing that will save the system. the U.S. dollar as a fixed exchange rate denominator. It's an arbitrary value. It is not a value, in a sense, intrinsic value. It's something which is politically defined. We say, in order for us to survive and to maintain our credit systems internationally, we must have a fixed exchange rate dollar, because there's no other currency that can perform that function. This does not mean that the dollar is entirely an utterance of credit from the United States. It doesn't mean that. It means that the U.S. dollar at parity is the standard which of stability for the world. And there is no other instrument that can do that at this time under these conditions. If you don't do it, the whole world goes to hell. So what are you fighting about? Who cares about China-U.S. relations under those circumstances? Either you do it or you don't. If you do it, then you don't have a problem with China. Now, the problem is with us, with our deficit system, is that our dollar is actually undervalued in those terms. If we look at what the future of the dollar is and its value, assuming that we take the initiative to restore a fixed exchange rate system of a slightly new form, then the dollar becomes immensely very valuable. And the problem is fixed. But you've got to think in the right terms. Right now, China is on the verge of disintegration. If the amount of trade between the United States and China declines, then China will not expand. If China does not expand its production, if it does not, well, therefore, what's the solution? China, instead of exporting to us, has to develop itself. Instead of trying to export to us, it has to produce for its own internal needs. What's its problem? China is the only part of the world which has communist billionaires. They're a dominant factor in the situation. Communist Party billionaires, Communist Party officials, the big fellows of the Communist Party. And on the other hand, you have some of the poorest people in the world in China, in great numbers, as in India. The problem of Asia is that the Asian culture is an oligarchical culture. The advantage of the United States is it comes from a European culture in which the struggle since ancient Greece and since the time of Solon of Athens, the struggle has been to develop a society based on the people, not the oligarchy. The struggle between Sparta and Athens, between Lycurgus Sparta and Solon's Athens, was a struggle of oligarchism against freedom. Europe, even though it's gone through terrible oligarchies, has been influenced by those revolutions in European policy which have established the principle that every human being is human and is therefore intrinsically equal by the virtue of being human. We are not monkeys. Admittedly, some of our politicians, like some in the White House, are monkeys, but most of us are human. And we recognize that as a principle. In other societies, including China, the idea of the sacredness of the individual personality is not recognized, not in practice. And this is an Asian problem. It is not a China problem. It's an Asia problem. Now, our task was, as has been, is to assist the nations of Asia in acquiring the basis for establishing for themselves the kind of freedom we, in our best moods, demand of ourselves. And that's our mission. So therefore, we're going to increase the value of the dollar, because by making the dollar the source of the world's greatest influx of public credit, regulated credit, suddenly on the basis of doing that and telling the British to pull their pants up, we will immediately increase the relative value of the dollar. The value of the dollar relative to the Chinese currency is a problem of the U.S. system, not a problem of China, or not a problem of U.S.-China relations as such. If I were president, I guarantee you, I would increase the value of the dollar by leaps, and that would solve the problem. If you're unwilling to do that in the United States, don't complain about China. That's the problem. See, it's the problem of our politicians. You have to take it's Cartesian thinking. It's the people who believe in these idiot reports about statistical reports forecasting. They're all fake. They're all incompetent. And our members of Congress are sucked into believing this crap. They have economists who tell them this. They have others who tell them. It's all nonsense. It's gobbledygook. If I were president of the United States, I could fix this problem without having to argue with China. Matter of fact, I would get excellent cooperation from China. I know something about China. Not everything, but I know some things. And they're important. I know some things about India. And they're important. I don't know everything, but I know some things. I discussed some of these problems with people like Indira Gandhi and people like that in earlier times. So I know these kinds of things. If I were president of the United States, I'd have no problem. Well, I don't intend to become president of the United States right now. So therefore, I've got to make sure that this job is done as I would have it done. And that's the way we fix the problem.
For those of you who are listening via the internet, you're listening to a live presentation in Washington by Lyndon LaRouche. You can submit questions to Mr. LaRouche, and we will entertain them as time allows. Lynn, this is another question on in a similar vein. This one is from the House side, and this one is from a freshman congressman. The other one was not. The other one was from a senior senator. This question is, Mr. LaRouche, when Bob Rubin addressed us, we didn't get a chance to ask him everything we would have liked to, but most of what he was asked had to do with questions surrounding the issue of trade. One of the things he said was that while he recognized the problems and the failures of globalization, that at this particular time he would not necessarily favor shutting down suddenly shutting down these liberal trade agreements, because it would not help us, and it would also serve to collapse the economies of other nations. He also surprised me by saying that he thought that demanding labor and environmental concessions from low-wage countries like India and China, or enacting what he called tit-for-tat trade policy deals, would ultimately not lead to progress. He insisted that the cure lies in our domestic policy. He talked about better education, a stronger safety net of healthcare insurance and economic security in retirement, defense of the dollar, and all of that coupled with policies directed to address our infrastructure needs as the more crucial elements necessary to grow the economy, and also what he said, equally importantly, to induce the kind of optimism that will allow us to compete and prevail regardless of what the trade environment was. In some respects, this bears similarities to what you're saying, but I also recognize there are differences. Can you please address this question overall from the standpoint that Mr. Rubin did?
You have to understand the difference between me and Bob Rubin. It's not a difference, a conflict difference. It's a difference that he is a banker and who operates from the standpoint of what he must do as a leading banker as opposed to what I must do or people like me must do to solve the problems within which he's trying to apply banking functions. In other words, if the politicians of the United States confront Bob Rubin with what they are willing to do as reality, then he is going to try to adapt to that reality as best he can within the framework of what the conditions they impose upon him by their policy shaping. On the other hand, he would have entirely personally and professionally wishes for what the United States would agree to do, which might be quite different in their implications from what he's supporting. Because he's saying, I'm a banker. I'm a banker on the block. I have to operate within the banking system. And what the government does by its policy to determine the way the banking system can operate is the things I must be guided by in my day-to-day policy-shaping operations. If, on the other hand, you give me a more opportune type of set of circumstances, as you politicians, then I would happily, enthusiastically join you in shaping policies which are opposite to those I have now, which I would prefer but I don't make those policies. In other words, you have to look at this man as a leading, competent professional who is not a baby boomer, which is one of his sources of genius. And he is adapting to the reality the politicians create. Now, if you coming into the Congress now, you have to look at the thing from your standpoint and have an insight into what I just said about Bob Rubin. Don't assume that Bob Rubin is going to play the role of leading politician and banker at the same time. At a round table, in a confidential round table discussion with some people, he will discuss the whole gamut of what his preferences are, what he thinks we should do, as opposed to what he thinks he can do based on what we think we will do. He will say, give me a better policy than this one. They say, no. He says, well, then I have to go back to this policy I don't like very much, but it was my best option as a banker. That's what the problem is. Now, therefore, it is up to the people in the Congress now, and especially in many respects in the ferment which is going to be erupting and bubbling inside the House of Representatives. It's up to the body there to take up the self-education, the rapid self-education policy process to understand this. Don't try to come in with common sense and try to find a common sense solution to common sense problems. It's the system that's defining everything. And what's needed is a change in the system. You have to take something like Myron Scholes and his crowd and take them out. Get them out there collecting garbage or something that's useful. Not forecasting. No hindcasting either. We have to have competence. And we have, look, the way I do it with a youth woman, the way competence develops is not by dictating to people what they should believe. It's challenging them, sometimes in a very rough way, to force them to face the realities which they must face and problems they must solve for themselves. I know that process works. It does not work according to formula. It does work according to principles. I know how young people's minds are turned on. And if they start to do that before the age of 27, they got a good chance. If they wait until later, they have a difficult choice because you get the wrong habits settled in. You give up on being creative. You try to be professional instead of creative, and that's not very good. So what you rely upon is the younger people coming in as freshmen into the Congress, usually younger, not always, who has not been in the system beforehand, now are in a natural situation where they have to ask questions. They have to get a quick education, but it has to be questions. It has to be also challenging. These young guys came in, or younger generation came in, saying, we want Cheney out. We want Cheney out. We want Cheney out. We want Cheney out. They all came in singing that song. The marching song of the soldiers of Congress. We want out. So therefore, they also want a solution for the general problems that face the American people. They come in not so much soaked with the doctrinaire character of the Democratic Party machinery, which is sometimes a snuff operation called the Democratic Party leadership, intellectually anyway. And you want to get them in with a fresh view as representatives of the people in asking and discussing the questions on which the well-being of the people depends, challenging the Congress which they've entered as much as submitting to it. Huh? This idea, you know, of go along to get along, there's a time when that has to quit. And you have to come to a time where you challenge these guys. Say, look, we came fresh from the hustings, buddies. You're out there, you're up there, you think you're running the world. But we're out there and we see the effects of what you think you're doing. And it ain't good. Now let's have some discussion about this matter and let's find a way to fix the mess that we came up here to fix. And we need your help and cooperation in the discussion, which will lead to fixing it. And that's the way to go at it. These whole areas are really, the freshmen coming into the Congress now are a very valuable shock factor because they came in often as Democrats, in particular, they came in opposition to Howard Dean's National Committee. They came in despite Howard Dean. They were elected by the people in despite Howard Dean, probably because of Howard Dean, because they were in despite of Howard Dean. And they came in there to change things, to represent what they thought represent the issues which occupy the people out there, the suffering the people experience. They have to be heard. And we need a serious dialogue. We don't want a put down of the young, of the freshman congressman. We want to force the dialogue, which is what the American people want. They want the dialogue forced. Cut the crap out. Get rid of the usual crap, and let's get down to business and face the reality. Let's not go with the issues. Forget the issues. Some of those issues think pretty badly. Go instead with the interests of the people, and go especially with what the two coming generations of the people's interests are. What's the interest of the people of the nation, two generations? What's the interest of the grandchildren, today's grandchildren? Those things have to be discussed. And you have to reformulate the questions first. And what I see, the key question is, we are on the biggest crisis the world's ever seen in terms of monetary economic affairs. It's global and it's immediate. And if we don't fix it, nothing else is going to work. So you better finally get your attention to this issue and realize this is the number one issue, which is you can do something about providing you put Cheney into retirement, probably in chains, and get adult supervision over the president.
Okay, here is a question from a freshman Democratic member of the House from New York, actually. This is Mr. LaRouche. I came to Washington largely by virtue of support from people who have not been historically poor, but whose standard of living has been driven down by the collapse of U.S. production. While I agree that an increase in the minimum wage is long overdue, and I will certainly vote to support it, I also don't think it's going to address the problems that are faced by this segment of the population. Even a higher minimum wage will not allow these people to meet their mortgage payments or pay their kids' tuition. I've looked at your economic proposals, and I happen to agree with them. I mean, really, who lives in this country and could argue against the need to rebuild our decrepit national infrastructure? But my question is, what about those of us who work in private sector industry, things like the garment industry, the shoe industry, things like that that depend on consumer spending? It would seem that the only way to address those problems is by somehow addressing the issue of trade policy and outsourcing. I don't know any other alternative. I'd be interested in your thoughts on this.
First of all, we have to go back to what some people call a protectionist mode. We have to. There's no sane alternative to returning to a protectionist mode. Now, on the minimum wage thing, look at the history of this proposition. What we did largely during the Roosevelt did it in several steps, but one of the most important aspects of the minimum wage policy was that in order to secure a federal government contract, and this then was extended to states, that to get the contract you had to adhere to a minimum wage standard. Trade unions became a significant factor in lobbying for negotiation of these trade conditions. Now, that's fine. It's good. Because even the proposed minimum wage does not meet the standard required for creating a family in the United States. And you look around and you find phenomena like these large super markets, which you have people who are vastly overweight, standing in one position because they have difficulty moving. And they're steering people to counters where merchandise may or may not exist. So you have people employed in this kind of way, and they become a larger and larger component of the population. And this is a real problem. The real problem here is we have cut down the number of productive employment places in the United States as a percentage of the total labor force. That's where the problem lies. But at the same time, you have to think of the cultural factor of the minimum wage in terms of what a minimum wage buys. And therefore, we have destroyed the ability to maintain a family. We have created problems among young people as a result of the decline in the standard of living in typical households across the United States. We have destroyed the orientation toward a future. So therefore, yes, we have to do that. Now, we have to, in a sense, say that we have a sense of national economic security in terms of tariff and trade. Now, national economic security is to ensure that in certain industries, you do have a tariff protection. In other words, we're going to have to go out there and bust up the whole operation, the entirety of this recent development in terms of globalized economy. It has to be busted up. Otherwise, no economy for us, no economy for anyone else either. So therefore, we're going back to a protectionist system, which is the traditional American system. And as a matter of fact, the present agreements which the United States has entered into in international agreements on tariffs and trade have been actually unconstitutional, violations of the preamble of the Constitution. And therefore, we find ourselves in a position where we regret very much we have to announce our withdrawal from these agreements. We are now entered into new agreements from that point on. But the key thing flows from, we have to start from the top. We have to reorganize from the top. We must reorganize, first of all, the international monetary financial system. It has to be reorganized on the basis of a rather relatively fixed exchange rate for the U.S. dollar, which will stabilize the world. And by the way, if we don't do that, if we do not make that change that I've just indicated, then the whole world is going to blow up very soon, and all these other questions will become irrelevant. So it has to be done that way. There has to be a tariff and trade provision, particularly of the garment and shoe industry. For example, you get cheap garments today that you can't get good ones. You can't even get a good set of underwear. For example, you take the gauge. Like an old man like me, you know, you go out and you buy some undershorts. And being an old miser like me, you have some old undershorts you had from 10, 12 years ago. And you take your undershorts out of the drawer, right? And you look at the recent ones from Honduras and the ones you used to get from mills in the United States. And you look at by a very simple standard, what is the gauge of the thread and the gauge of the fabric which you're sitting on? And why are you getting blisters by typing? Our problems in this nature, we require a standard of quality of merchandise, as this illustrates. You see, the poor guy down there in Honduras, who's a bunch of slaves, is down there working like that because he's a slave, working to make everything cheaper for the benefit of some shark up here or in the national markets. And therefore, in order to make the product cheaper, they take the gauge out of the fabric. And you say, what am I sitting on here? Is there anything there?
That should not be taken as an argument in favor of going commando. Okay, let's see. Okay. Mr. LaRouche, I'm a newcomer to Congress, but not to Washington. And in these opening days, the incoming class has been bombarded with explanations of what can and cannot be done. But the veteran legislator's view of what can and cannot be done is precisely what has led to the perception of a do-nothing Congress. Now, individually, the truth is that not a single one of us has a chance. In recognition of this, some of us have been discussing the idea of forming a freshman caucus so that we actually could address certain issues with one voice backed up by a significant number of votes. We have been told that this is a very bad idea. What do you think about something like this? We're not trying to be disruptive, but we are trying to figure out how we can be heard.
If anyone has studied in recent years my policies on an adult youth movement, they know exactly what I think about this. What you need is, you need, as I said before in answer to a previous question, you need the vitality of ferment. And the vitality of ferment is the younger generation saying to the older generation, this place is kind of screwed up. Maybe you'd had something to do with that? Why don't you at least listen to and discuss some different ideas from a slightly different perspective? Why don't you, you know, it's like a man walking down the street. He feels he's all well-dressed. He's got all the front of him is nice, the tie, so forth. But the guy from behind says, oh boy, what a wreck he is. So the fellows coming up behind a certain generation will often see things that the fellow who's looking at himself in the mirror frontally overlooks. And therefore, this idea of, yes, a freshman caucus, it is not really a controversial issue. It's a question of, it's a normal generational process. The people who've gone through, who are the older generation, or have been habituated to think like the older generation, think in a certain way. This way has ruined us. But these guys maybe have ruined us, in a sense. But they're patriots, at least a great number. So therefore, because they realize the system is coming down, because they realize it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked, and it's not going to work, they realize they have to have a certain openness. Look what happened in the recent election, particularly with our intervention in it, the youth intervention, and look at the result. And look at what we're doing in terms of the continuation based on the bel canto principle of choral singing in terms of political organizing. We are making a revolutionary change in politics. And you see the marginal contribution of that younger generation, with its increased role in the recent midterm elections, has determined the present change which has occurred in the Congress. The landslide character of the Democratic victory in the House of Representatives is a reflection of the 18 to 35 younger voter, the increased relative increment of that vote turning out against the present system. So therefore, you find the freshman congressmen who are new to the system, that part of the system, are reflecting that as a group. Systemically. This is the way the Democratic Party has come back into existence after a long sitting in a sort of a suspended animation. And that's the way this country will go forward. You find the reflection of that is not simply the anti-Bush war and so forth from Republicans. The important thing that you're seeing in the legislative process in the United States today is a reflection that the fact that a new, younger generation has manifested itself as a force in politics, an increasing force in politics, has changed the mood and thinking among older generations of politicians. And therefore, we say that's the coming generation. The Democratic Party is now in the process of virtually regaining what it lost in 1968. And therefore, an old generation screwed this thing up. A new generation will fix it.
Lynn, we have, there are more questions on some of these issues from both members of Congress and from a couple from professional staffers who we have been working with. I will get to those questions, but we are being bombarded with questions on the situation right now in the Middle East and in Africa And I do want to take a couple of those questions because there are so many of them. And they're coming both from the United States and internationally, from young people and old people as well. Not old, just not youth. I don't want to get in trouble by saying somebody's old. The questions actually cover two areas that are related. One is characterized by a question that was submitted from Mr. Abdulrazak Abdulrahman, who's in the audience here, who says, Mr. LaRouche, what is the current Ethiopian administration doing in Somalia? And the other questions are all asking you to please comment on the recent U.S. bombing in Somalia.
Well, the recent bombing in Somalia is a reflection of the extension of Cheney's intention to behind the surge in Iraq and behind Cheney's intention to have a war against Iran. This is a long-term process, and it's all evil. The policy on Africa, well, as such, you can date it from 1898 and Kitchener. That's the secret. If you look at Kitchener and what British policy was after the victory in Sudan, that you will see exactly the whole trend in policy up to date. This is an imperial policy. You're dealing with to understand this, our enemy is the British government, or the Anglo-Dutch liberal forces behind that government. The intent has been, as since 1763, since February 1763 to be specific, is the intention of the British East India Company, which is now essentially the core of what has been transmogrified as the current British establishment, Anglo-Dutch liberal establishment, has been to create a world empire based on the model, not a copy of, but the model on, the Venetian control of the Norman chivalry during the so-called medieval period. That's the policy, that kind of empire. Not a Roman empire in the sense of ancient Rome or Byzantium as such, but something which is based on the same principle but has a different form. That is where a consort of bankers, like a slime mold, different groups of bankers who quarrel with each other but who also as a unit have certain common policies, certain parameters, who run a private and other military forces, set up wars and other ways of controlling masses of people. And the intent of this crowd has been since 1763 to establish a British empire, which is actually an empire of the Anglo-Dutch liberal circles, which would control the British and Dutch monarchies and things like that. So now the imperial policy, Africa has been part of that. Two policies are part of that. One is, apart from the enemy, the British have always been the enemies of the existence of the United States since that time, since 1763. But the policy has been in respect to Africa and Eurasia, has been, in case of Eurasia, the policy has been since Abraham Lincoln's victory over the British puppet called the Confederacy. The policy has been called geopolitics. The British Empire came to power by orchestrating the 7 Years' War leading into the 1763 Treaty of Paris. The British Empire perpetuated its power and increased it through its agent, Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, Napoleon Bonaparte didn't know he was a British agent, but what he did in destroying Europe, continental Europe, with his wars on Europe, just weakened Europe to the extent that the British Empire has control. With the exception of the Roosevelt administration, the British Empire has controlled the world, politics, in Europe, especially, since that time, since especially the assassination of McKinley. Now, Africa policy is a special policy which is part of that. The policy of Africa, of the British toward Africa, is that expressed by Henry Kissinger in 1974. And his proposal specifically on Africa was, the African population is too large. It is consuming too much of its own natural resources, which we want for our future. We don't want Africans using that up. We do not wish to have the African populations increase. We wish to cause them to decrease. We do not want Africans to increase their productive powers of labor. We want to prevent them from developing independent productive powers of labor in their own territory, so they will not use up raw materials which we think we own for the future by actually applying technological progress in that part of the world. Now, what we have now is, which is also very ancient, we don't have a conflict with Iran. We don't have a conflict with this. That's all nonsense. That's all secondary. What the issue is the way to destabilize the world is by taking an area called Southwest Asia, which is the junction point of Africa and Asia, and the reference point for Europe and Northern Asia, and destabilize that entire area. Look at it. That has been ever since documented European history. That cockpit around the Southwest Asia, Egypt, etc., cockpit has been the determinant of imperial policy before the Roman Empire, under the Roman Empire, during the Byzantine Empire, under the medieval Ultramontane system, and under the British Anglo-Dutch liberal system. So what's happening now is an attempt to disrupt and destabilize the region by causing a general conflagration extending all the way from Central Asia through Iran, Transcaucasia, from Turkey, down into the area of Lake Victoria. And the whole area is an area of geostrategic intentions. Now, this is not Cheney's policy. This is a British policy which Cheney works for under as a dumb thug, working for his wife, who is not so smart, but a little more intellectual. And she's a fascist. And Cheney is the dog she has on a leash, which she sometimes unleashes. And unleashed in the bedroom at least twice. So this is what we're dealing with. You have to deal not with a conflict, like a comic book story conflict or a Hollywood scenario. What you have to do is look at the fact we're dealing with human beings. And human beings are creatures of culture, of transmitted and developed culture, using the power of human beings to generate ideas, which no animal can develop. An animal is born and dies, and that's the end of that animal. It has no personality. A human being never dies, because when the body dies, the impact of ideas transmitted through them or developed by them continues to radiate in society. A human being is intrinsically, implicitly immortal, and what they represent as immortality is ideas. The domain of ideas rather than the domain of flesh as such. Therefore, when you're looking at this from the standpoint of human conduct, of human behavior, of culture, you see that the conflicts of this planet are cultural conflicts. As Henry Kissinger professes to be a Hobbesian, that it's a whole mental conception about man. Henry Kissinger is not a human being. He's denounced and torn up his membership card in the human race with these kinds of policies. Anybody else who has a similar policy has a similar thing. People who tear up their membership cards in the human race become what we call evil. And it takes the form of, you know, which was the biblical form in a sense, it takes the form of a struggle between good and evil. And what you're looking at with Cheney, looking with that poor, brainwashed, idiot president, with Liz Biz Cheney, what you're looking at is a struggle by the forces of evil. Not evil because they represent an empire of evil as such, but because they represent a cultural tendency within civilization whose characteristic is to do evil. And this is not normal, you know, evil is not something natural in the human race. It's a question of a degenerate generation of human beings. Human beings are naturally good. They're born good. But conditions and culture can turn a good person into a degenerate from the child of a baby, or bad culture can do that. So we're fighting against culture. What you're seeing here in this operation, you're seeing the force of evil. Now you take Ethiopia. Ethiopia had a war with Somalia. How'd this happen? Well, Henry Kissinger did it. How'd he do it? Going into the 1970s, before Kissinger really took a hand of this, Somalia had been supported by the Soviet Union. And Ethiopia had been supported by the U.S. and the Europeans. And the conflict was arranged. Henry Kissinger switched. He switched back and forth between... So the Soviets were now on Ethiopia, and the United States moved in with Henry Kissinger on Somalia. A war between Somalia and Ethiopia was orchestrated. At the same time, a war between Eritrea, which is and Ethiopia was orchestrated. A war to control the waters of the Nile from Lake Victoria to the Mediterranean Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, was orchestrated. An agreement was reached among nations Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt on water regulation. If you destabilize that area, as with Darfur, which is what is being done from the outside, then the water agreements are broken. Then the British take the water from the Nile, which was going to Egypt, put it in a pipeline, a plastic pipeline, and deliver the water to Israel. That's what's going on. And that's only part of the story. But that's the way to understand this. You have a force of evil, habitual evil, which Henry Kissinger really reflects and typifies, which engages in these kinds of operations not because there's a passionate cause which is endemic in certain governments and certain nations. It's not that. Somebody plays them. Look, the Seven Years' War in Europe, which made the British East India Company an empire, was played. The British supported Frederick of Prussia, Frederick the Great, against all of the enemies of Prussia in Europe. And you had a Seven Years' War regarding France, Russia, Austro-Hungary, and so forth, against Frederick the Great. The British gave him marginal financial support so he could deploy an army with his particular skill to the attacks on Prussia. Once the British had achieved what they wanted, they shut off the assistance to Frederick the Great and went back to other arrangements. As a result of this, Europe was so weakened relative to British power that the British have maintained power over Europe ever since that time. They reinforced that by orchestrating the Napoleonic Wars. It was the British intelligence service which put Napoleon into power in France. He was normally their enemy, but he fought the wars they wanted him to fight. He weakened all of Europe to the point that from the Vienna of Congress on, Europe was dominated to the present day, except for the intervention of the United States, was dominated by the Anglo-Dutch liberals. This is the way these guys operate. Don't think in the childish terms, the comic book terms of history, of thinking that because so-and-so hates so-and-so, that's why the war starts. The war starts because usually somebody is orchestrating a war among people, and the third party is orchestrating that war. And usually it's an imperial force. Like globalization, like what happened in 9/11. That's the way things happen.
Once again, you're listening to a live broadcast from Washington, D.C., by the American economist and statesman Lyndon LaRouche. Lynn, this is a question from a veteran member, veteran Democrat in the United States Senate. He says it was clear from Bush's remarks last night that he believes he has the authority as commander-in-chief to order a massive increase in the number of U.S. troops deployed to Iraq. Senator Kennedy challenged this idea before the fact in what I thought were eloquent remarks delivered on Tuesday, in which he announced that we now have introduced legislation into both houses of Congress to stop this suicidal escalation. At the same time, Senator Biden has opened what he said would be 4 weeks of hearings on the administration's Iraq policy. However, within hours of Bush's address, U.S. troops conducted a raid on an Iranian consulate in one of the Kurdish areas and took a number of Iranians into custody. When we have an administration that is prepared to trample on all accepted diplomatic norms and agreements, do we really have the time to conduct 4 weeks of hearings, or is emergency action necessary?
Emergency action is absolutely necessary, otherwise everything else is a waste of time. Okay? What you have is you have an administration which is acting as a dictatorship, just like Adolf Hitler. The forces behind this administration are the same interests which are represented by Adolf Hitler, for whom he worked. But after punishing the people who had worn uniforms in the Nazi service, we protected those in a discrete interval and restored to power those who had been behind Hitler in the United States and in Europe and in Germany itself. The interest which did that, which created the Hitler dictatorship, which Roosevelt mustered a defeat of this, those forces still exist today as a social force, as a social continuity. They have similar aims today to those which the British, the Bank of England and company had, and some people like Averell Harriman and company had in New York. Those people were behind Hitler. Many of them had been, like Churchill, behind Mussolini. And Churchill was backing Mussolini until 1939. And yet you had magazines like Liberty and so forth that had some of these features, articles by people on that. And it was a fact. I had a friend of mine who was serving up in that area as the chief of OSS in Italy on the ground. And he was chasing Mussolini, who was headed toward the border for a meeting with Churchill. Now, Churchill was scared stiff because Mussolini was going to try to blackmail Churchill to improve, shall we say, Mussolini's conditions of life. So somebody killed Mussolini, and the papers he was carrying with him disappeared until later, somewhat diminished in number and magnitude. And his body was, Mussolini and his girlfriend's body, was found hanging upside down in a gas station. And my friend, who had been chasing him with a .45 on his hip, knew that this was a big hoax. But those forces which were behind the Hitler, the Mussolini, and so forth, the forces which were behind the Liberty League here in the United States and similar kinds of people, these guys wanted Hitler. Because they loved him, but they would use him like toilet paper, which they threw away afterwards, and they got new toilet paper, some of which is named Cheney and some of it's named Bush.
That should not be taken as an excuse not to use toilet paper. Okay. Lynn, we have a couple of more questions on this topic, and then we're going to come back to these questions of economy. This is a question from a freshman member in the House of Representatives. He says, Mr. LaRouche, as a prelude to President Bush's speech, and I think not accidentally as such, the U.S. used massive force, supposedly in pursuit of three alleged al-Qaeda terrorists in Somalia. Last night, it seems we did something similar in a raid against an Iranian consulate. It seems that these days, absolutely anything is permissible in pursuit of al-Qaeda. Will you please give me your assessment of the actual terrorist threat that the U.S. faces and the best way of addressing it?
Well, the biggest terrorist threat we have right now is Vice President Cheney. It's a fact. Now, as to al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda was created essentially under the directorate of then Vice President George H.W. Bush, the father of the present incumbent, and Jimmy Goldsmith. What happened is, in the course of once Brzezinski had left office, and Brzezinski was the one who started this war in Afghanistan to, hit the flank of the Soviet Union in repayment for what had been done in Indochina, where the Soviet government had, when the United States had started the war with Indochina, in Indochina, the Soviet government had assisted the Vietnamese in designing strategies of irregular warfare or asymmetric warfare. So, therefore, the United States decided to return the favor by launching asymmetric warfare in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union as a trap, as a monkey trap for the Soviet Union. Now, in this process, the United States and Britain, as typified by the cases of Jimmy Goldsmith as an agent for Britain and George H.W. as a vice president of the United States, who was involved in what was called the Iran-Contra operation. So the Iran-Contra operation, as associated with George H.W. Bush, was involved in running terrorist operations against the Soviet forces in Afghanistan. They relied on cooperation with certain Saudi families and others to recruit a certain type of Islamic believer to become a fanatical fighter against the devil of Soviet ideology in Afghanistan. Among these was a member of a family, the bin Laden family, which is very close personally to the Bush family. The person who was involved most prominently was Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden created a terrorist organization which was deployed by the Anglo-American forces in Afghanistan against the Soviet forces. After the war had concluded and the fall of the wall and so forth, this al-Qaeda organization still existed, and the al-Qaeda of the bin Laden family maintained very close relationships to the most recent time with the Bush family in Texas. So al-Qaeda was a throwaway for somebody to use as a distraction and cover-up for the actual authorship of what became known as 9/11. This was a coup d'etat intended against the United States at a time I knew something like that was intended. As I said, before the inauguration of President George W. Bush in January of 2001, when I said on the basis of the indications of the incompetence of the Bush administration coming in, and the fact that we had already gone into a new phase of a general financial crisis with the collapse of the Y2K bubble in the course of 2000, that George W. Bush would be incapable with his policies and orientation of dealing efficiently and competently with that issue. And therefore, we must expect that somewhere in the woodwork, someone would do what Hermann Göring had done to make Hitler a dictator by setting fire to the Reichstag in 1933. So this is what happened is we were looking for a Reichstag-like event. We had one which was staged out of the Italian protests against globalization, which was a terrorist-type event, where Bush himself was threatened. And we then were looking at a prospective October security problem for Washington, D.C., which was being staged largely in Northern Virginia and other areas. So we were monitoring that. We knew that something was up. So on September 11th of that year, before what we were looking at as the potential of a Washington, D.C. terrorist event, 9/11 happened. And since the United States and others and the British had assets, which were terrorist assets from the operations in Afghanistan during the 1980s, there was no shortage of talent to decorate the environment to attribute this thing to an Islamic target. And the Islamic target comes from Samuel P. Huntington, who is a Kissinger associate from their time in Boston under William Mandel Elliott, who was a British agent, who trained a whole group of British agents, including Henry Kissinger, at Harvard University's Unit of Government. And so you have that kind of situation. And this is the kind of problem we face. Now, we're looking at the use of what are methods of asymmetric warfare. in place of or in supplement of actual acts of conventional warfare. That is, you start an asymmetric war the way Hitler started the Polish event, which led to the beginning of official World War II. You stage an act of asymmetric warfare as a provocation to create an issue which then becomes the pretext for general warfare. So what they've done all the since is Al-Qaeda, who Osama bin Laden has never been taken, there's never been a serious attempt to take him, despite all bombing of all holes in sight. Osama bin Laden has never shown up. We wonder if he's at a place called the Crawford Ranch. One place that has not yet been bombed. Even by a certain lady who was terrifying George. So what you're dealing with here, you're dealing with what would be considered diplomatically as criminal acts, such as this Iran consul event, on the pretext of Al-Qaeda, which is an operation created under the patronage or the co-patronage of George H.W. Bush, in this area. What you're having is somebody's playing games. They're trying to incite the situation, which leads to, through asymmetric conflict, which leads to the launching of an aerial bombardment using nuclear weapons in Iran. At the point that that occurs, which is what the meaning of the surge is in Baghdad, the surge in Baghdad is a flanking operation to support something in Iran, a bombing of Iran. That's what it is. The president probably doesn't know that, but there's many things the president doesn't know. Probably where his shoes are. We must not overestimate the intelligence of George W. Bush. If you wanted to destroy the United States, the first thing you would do from London is make George W. Bush the president and Cheney the vice president. That's happened, hasn't it? The United States has never been so discredited, so low in its diplomatic influence, its credibility, its influence on world affairs as now, as a result of the administration of George W. Bush and the actions of Cheney. The United States is being destroyed from within by the installation of these clowns and their supporters inside our institutions of government. And people in the Congress ought to understand that. These bums have to be put out because they are worse than traitors.
You know, in all the years that I've been associated with you, you've put on the table a number of things that were incredible challenges. But you can't do this. But probably the biggest challenge, I think, that Lynn has ever put before us was what he just said, which is to not overestimate the intelligence of George Bush. Lynn, this is a question that I think the questioner probably knows the answer to, but I think she wants you on record as saying it. This is from a senior staffer on the House side and a good friend. And she says, Lynn, I'm sure you know we have a $9 trillion overall deficit. And there is no question that Bush's tax cut exacerbated that problem greatly. I'd like you to just address for a moment what you think can and should be done vis-a-vis our tax policy to deal with the situation.
Well, first of all, the upper income brackets of the population should finally take their fair share of the burden. Also, there should be a heavy tax on accompanied by criminal measures against speculation of the type of hedge funds. The world is being destroyed by this kind of financial speculation, which is contrary to the intent of our Constitution. U.S. banks are involved with that. The U.S. banks have put the United States dollar into jeopardy through their hedge fund operations internationally. As a result of hedge fund operations conducted by these banks, condoned by the U.S. government presently, Every major U.S. bank in the United States is currently, in fact, bankrupt. There's not a solid major bank in the United States today. That's why I think Bob Rubin would agree with me. Well, he doesn't like to say it, but he would agree with the effect. But I say put the entire Federal Reserve System in receivership. Now, what has happened by these hedge funds and similar kinds of operations of financial derivatives, with the housing bubble, the Y2K bubble, all these other bubbles, the United States has incurred a debt beyond belief. There is no possible way of scheduling the amount of outstanding claims against the financial system in the world today. None. Therefore, much of this debt must be canceled. Now, therefore, it should be the finding of the Congress that this practice of allowing the hedge fund and related financial derivatives operations introduced heavily under former head of the Federal Reserve System, Alan Greenspan, that this practice was wrong and should be considered, because of its effect, as criminal by effect and also by intent. Now, therefore, what do you do in a case like this? You pass two laws which are the same thing, or two sets of laws. One, you ban it. Two, such activity becomes now a subject of the criminal law. In other words, it's like raping children. It's a crime. Stop it. This is raping nations, raping people, raping the banking system. This is a crime. Stop it. And that is essentially the way you have to look at it. The purpose, U.S. dollar is our asset. It's a U.S. government asset under our Constitution. Someone who tampers with the dollar, who counterfeits the dollar, should be a Treasury Department target for enforcement. Now, who is the biggest counterfeiter in recent history? Well, one, for example, candidate is Alan Greenspan. Look what he did. Look what he did. He created the housing bubble. How did he do that? Mortgage-based securities, using his flood of phony money through Fannie Mae and other institutions. How was the whole operation run during the 1990s to the present time? Him. Since 1987, him. Greenspan. The whole system was rotted out by this use of financial derivatives, by him, and speculative instruments. What is the status of, take the case of Loudoun County, Virginia, an area with which I have some familiarity. This area is hopelessly bankrupt. The county was sucked into being stupid by some of the residents who prevailed. What they did is they promoted a housing bubble expansion in a bedroom community called Loudoun County. Without infrastructure, you have fancy houses in a million-dollar class, and you've got sewage coming up to the lawn, which means that the county planning ain't so good because there are no sewage systems. We got some Irish moss something or other, and it helps the sewage get to the ground more quickly. So now what's happened is Loudoun County is the most vulnerable target in terms of scale in the nation of a complete blowout of the housing bubble, the mortgage housing bubble. This goes down. What happens to the county? First of all, you have a lot of housing in which people are in debt for housing they occupy, where they have less than zero equity in their holding. As the price of the housing value on the market declines, and as the accumulated of unsold housing for sale rises, you reach a point there will be a general bubble blowout of the housing bubble, including the particular Loudoun County Center. What happens then to expenses of maintaining the government functions of Loudoun County under those circumstances? The county itself goes bankrupt. And you have potential chaos in the county. Insoluble chaos under present regulations. And this is the kind of thing. Therefore, this findings of this kind of fact, as you find in California, elsewhere, the same kind of thing. And also in London, is the worst thing in the London area. A terrible situation in Spain, and so forth and so on. So therefore, here we have a pestilence, which is a threat to life and well-being, generally, of humanity, called hedge funds and related financial derivatives. This should be banned. Certainly, we'd ban opium traffic, cocaine traffic. This should be banned. This is criminal traffic. It's a drug traffic of this form. Therefore, we ban it. We confiscate the assets, illegal assets, and we tax it all at the same time, just the way we have taxes on criminal income. We put them in jail, and we tax them at the same time. It's a double penalty. So that's the way you have to approach this kind of thing if you want to be serious, because we're never going to pay those debts. Never. We never could. Try to pay them, you'll collapse the system. So you can never pay the existing outstanding debts, largely denominated in dollars. The only what you can do is disavow them.
That's exactly what I keep telling my creditors. Okay. They're not friendly to the idea, though. This is a question that was submitted by Heather, who's one of the leaders of the LIM here in D.C., and I think it's a useful question to have addressed. She says, Lynn, in your recent paper, you've outlined clearly the type of curriculum which some professional staff and members of Congress have to take up in order to think more clearly about the long-term cycles of economics. The LIM, spearheaded by the animation crews, are slowly but surely working toward understanding the basis of modern science and classical modes of communication. This, I believe, can be seen in the qualitative improvements in our deployments overall. What my worry is that these people need to take your scientific core curriculum more seriously if they wish to make real economic policy for the future of this country and the world. So we're thinking about how to integrate this teaching into the Congress itself. And I was wondering if you had any advice on how we might approach this question.
Yeah, sure. This is what I'm interested in. I'm interested, of course, very much in the progress of certain projects. Now, you have, for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll be having a report on the second series on Kepler's discoveries. The first one was on the discovery of gravitation and the inner planet relationship, the subject of his book, The New Astronomy. The second one is on his World Harmonies, which is the organization of the solar system from the same standpoint. And what they've been doing is, going through each part. See, as I've said a number of times, the peculiar thing about Kepler is he's actually the founder of the application form of modern physical science. And for years, most people in universities and so forth have known nothing about Kepler, and therefore many people who would consider themselves scientists are actually incompetent in astrophysics for that is, in other related things for just that reason. But the peculiarity of Kepler, apart from the originality of his work, as Albert Einstein emphasized later, is that in his writings, he takes the reader through every step of definition of the data of the problem. So the reader has to go through the experience of making the discovery, himself or herself. It's contrary to what you get of learning the formula in a typical, with a little fast pitch in the university today. Now, what this does is then leads to a mind which is capable, with the help of going back to the Pythagoreans and Plato, on the method of spherics, as capable of understanding the fundamental principle of scientific work, fundamental scientific work, leaving aside a lot of things which are very important, but let's get the mainstream first. So you get through the mainstream, right? Then you go through the work of Gauss, which is, in respect to astronomy, which is based on Kepler and Leibniz. And then you go from Gauss to Riemann's conception of dynamics. And if you don't understand Riemannian physical dynamics, you don't understand anything, really, functionally, about how an economy actually works. So therefore, it is what we're getting so far is from the young people, the young people who are working on these projects, are producing at the end of each cycle on the project, are producing a report, a presentation back to others, and various kinds of discussions as well. We also, in a sense, are spreading a capability throughout the ranks of the LIM, a capability of dealing with the concept of science in a way which is superior to the presentation of science and aspects to universities today. So therefore, this is immediately replicable for application to questions of economy from a physical economic standpoint today. So yes, that's what's to be done. Exactly. And you find some people in the Congress who will have either staff members or others and so forth who would like to participate in the reports that we generate from these sessions and make those available to them and get some kind of a clinical process of discussion with various people in the Congress to strengthen the staff capability of the relevant Congress. If you get a number of congressmen who've increased their capability through the improvement of their staff's capability, it'd be a nice benefit. And I think that's the way to go.
Okay, we are running out of time. So what I'm going to do, the last question that I'm going to ask Lynn, is a question that's been asked both by a new member of the House and also by a LIM member. And I'll read each of them because they're both the same question, just addressed in slightly different ways. And I'll let Lynn answer it. What I won't ask Lynn, but I think he will answer at some other time in some other place, is the one topic outside of Iraq and the economy that we have gotten more questions on from the United States and from Europe, but gratefully from only two people on Capitol Hill, is questions surrounding Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And I don't want to take up the time here, even though it would give Lynn a lot of good comic material. I think one inconvenient truth for Mr. Gore is that he's not any better at making movies than he is at politics. But, but Lynn, here's a question that was submitted by a freshman in Congress, and then I'll read you the LIM question. One of the freshmen asks, he says, Mr. LaRouche, when Bob Rubin came to talk to us, the first thing that he said was that he wasn't licensed to practice politics. But I get the sense that you are. There are some very complex and technical issues that clearly we have to address with legislation. But the fact is that very few Americans are interested in or follow Congress's legislative agenda. My own view is that, nevertheless, we owe it to our constituents to find a way to educate them on the details without boring them to death. And I'm not sure exactly how to do that. Now, a related question came in from Betsiana Gonzalez, who's here from the Argentinian LaRouche Youth Movement, and we'd like to welcome her. Her question addresses the same issue. I think it just does it more eloquently. She says, Lynn, the subject of my question is the pursuit of happiness in terms of the general welfare and how to actually organize the population with ideas and with beauty instead of just bombarding them with mere information.
Well, let's go to the happiness first. The pursuit of happiness is the same thing, in a sense. The pursuit of happiness is a concept which is presented by Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz, as featured in his new Essays on Human Understanding, a rebuttal of John Locke. And in this, in contrast to the utilitarian, vulgar attitude of Locke, Leibniz signified that essentially happiness lies in the immortality of the individual soul. That are you doing something with the life, the mortal life you have, which you are persuaded is going to be of merit for the benefit of coming generations? If so, and if you die in the effort to do that, then you have happiness. One of the best examples of that is the case of a student, a famous student of Abraham Kastner, the famous mathematician and also an expert in areas of culture, of Gotthold Lessing, of the famous Mendelssohn-Lessing alliance, which launched the great classical renaissance in the end of the 18th century. And Lessing led a life which is inherently very bitter in terms of the circumstances. The wife, after years of trying to get married to his wife, she died very quickly after that, and so forth. And yet he maintained a positive attitude about life, no matter what he went through. His dramas are especially notable for that particular quality. That is happiness, to be able to face death with a smile on your face, because you've made a contribution to the future of humanity, which affirms you as a human being as opposed to a mere mortal animal. That's the issue. The problem has been that the introduction of existentialism, which of course is all throughout Ibero-America, as well as in the United States. Existentialism, the idea of what this Nazi, Martin Heidegger, called thrownness, of being you are a thing thrown into a jungle, which is called society, and you interact as jungle creatures against each other. The idea of Horkheimer or Hannah Arendt and people like that express this. So the idea that you are not a person in a human jungle, as the fascists think, or the Nazis think. You are a person in society playing a role as an immortal intellect in the future of humanity. And your goal is not what you get in your pocket, not your essential satisfaction. Your goal is to leave a life which at the end you can smile and say, the future of what I have done seems to me virtually assured to someone who comes after me. This is what is lacking in the baby boomer generation, especially the upper 20% of family income brackets in the United States today. This is what the baby boomer problem is. And it comes out as they get older. Because if you are an existentialist by inclination, in this sense, and you become older, you become bitter. You become mean. You become resentful against everything. You want your way. It's my life. I'm going to die. Who cares about you? You're not. It's your time. This is my time. I want what I got coming to me now. And that's the baby boomer. So therefore, what you're facing with a baby boomer-dominated culture, which has been infiltrated by the influence of existentialist doctrine, as in the case of Argentina or Brazil or so forth, you find this in Mexico, you find existentialism all over the place, in art and so forth. That's where the problem lies. And it's the motivation in which society is built is by the dedication of the individual and the existing generation to the future of mankind. This used to be expressed as immigrants in the United States would come here, live under difficult circumstances, work under difficult circumstances, and look forward to the future of their grandchildren. They came in as immigrant labor. Their grandchildren became the physicians, the scientists, and so forth in the United States. Now, well, the way to set the agenda is to not just fight against what is going on now under Nancy Pelosi's leadership in terms of her special agenda, which can become a trap because it seems good, but it leads nowhere. The fundamental issue of determining the future of the existence of the nation is not discussed. So therefore, what do you have to do? You have a parallel track. Let that track go on. Let them discuss it. Fine. All these are all interesting issues to discuss. Let them discuss it and vote it up and down. But let us at the same time make sure we don't lose track of the vital issue. Is this nation, is this civilization going to survive? That's the question. That's the fundamental question. Once you understand what you mean by that, and understand what you mean by a solution to that challenge, now you can legislate. If you haven't faced that question first, you don't have a yardstick by which to measure what the true result should be. And that's the point. So therefore, what we do, just not fuss with these guys who insist on going with a small-minded agenda, of point by point. Don't fuss with them. What we do is take the people who reveal themselves to be real leaders by the fact they can go to the higher level of the agenda. What are the issues? What is the legislation which should determine the future existence of this nation and its role in the world? Start from that. Now look at every one of the issues that come up from that standpoint, and you probably will get it pretty nearly right.
Okay, well, we've accomplished bringing in the new politics, and now we've got quite a job on our hands in bringing in the new economics. But I think that if you take the quality of the discussion that has been presented here today, it's clear that we have the best shot that we could possibly hope for in doing that. The LIM has been extremely effective this week. And I'm sure that they will continue to be extremely effective as this week progresses and even as they go back to the various areas that they came here from. I'd like to thank all of you. You've been a very good audience. For those of you who did not get your questions answered, we will try to get as many of them answered in the coming days as possible. And beyond that, I'd like to ask you once again to join me in thanking Lynn for taking the time today.